This is the New Glarus Brewing Podcast with Dan Carey. I am Scott May, and Dan is back in our studio with me this week to talk again about sort of the things that define beer and brewing, that sort of words and phrases and concepts that get tossed out that, you know, maybe you're familiar with, but you don't know exactly what it means or everything that goes into it. And we did one of these episodes before where we sort of broke down the entire brewing process. And we thought we'd do a second one because some of the questions that sort of cropped up around there also had to do with sort of how beer is consumed and the words and phrases and ways in which this, you know, great product, once it goes from brewing to fermenting to bottling, everything from the mouth onward, I guess. Does that sound about right, Dan? Yeah,
that sounds good to me.
Well, in a previous episode, I had used the word mouth-feely, and someone asked me to define mouth-feely. I would define that as the feeling you get in your mouth after you have drank your beer and you've experienced the mouth-feel. But what is mouth-feel in general? And after that, why don't we have a better word for it?
Well, I guess mouthfeel is something that has to do with all beverages and all foods, that the sensation that you get in your mouth when you eat something or drink something, because when we talk about taste, we're really talking about four or five things. Mm-hmm. Salty, sour, bitter, and sweet, and then umami, which is a Japanese term to do with a kind of a special savory type place, type taste that you taste on your tongue. Mm-hmm. And then in your nose, when you put something in your mouth and you taste it, the aroma that are volatile go up into your nose and you smell them. And that's where you get all of the flavors of fruits and like. But the last thing is how does it feel in your mouth? It's some foods and beers and wines will have an astringency, a tannic character. And this is due to polyphenols, which are reacting with the proteins in your mouth and making this sort of pain feeling. Mm-hmm. Carbon dioxide gas also has a prickly taste, a feeling in your mouth. Some beers feel velvety and smooth, and some beers feel jaggedy and rough. Mm-hmm. So mouthfeel has to do with how the beer feels in your mouth. Is it thin and watery? Does it feel full and syrupy? Does it feel astringent and harsh or sweet? And so these characteristics are all about the mouthfeel of the beer. And generally, you want a beer to have some feeling of substance, a full mouthfeel, or as the Germans would say, vollmundig, full mouth feeling, so that the beer, you know that there's something of substance that you're drinking.
That makes a lot of sense. One of my, when I spent my year in Vermont, one of my favorite things to do is there's one of these restaurants just down the hill from me that are prevalent on sort of the East Coast and all the way till you get to Chicago. And basically what I call them is they're counter service restaurants that kind of have everything. That's like, yeah, we got pizza and we got gyros, we got sub sandwiches,
sushi.
And yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, whatever, but they had these fries and they were really, really good French fries. I love them. They were like my favorite. But after I would eat them, it would literally feel like somebody had coated my mouth in grease, right? It just felt bad after I ate them on my palate. It stayed with me. Is there a beer that can taste great and have a bad mouthfeel, or are the two sort of mutually exclusive?
Well, I mean, you know, I mean, that's like kind of saying, can you have a great song with a bad intro?
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess you could, but certainly the introduction to the beer, how it feels when you put it in your mouth, is important to the whole experience. So certainly you can, but if I taste a beer and it doesn't taste right, it tastes thin or way too full, I'm not going to have high expectations for that beer. So in general, it's part of the harmony of a beer, the experience of drinking a beer. You know, you really want a beer to be to have a low intensity when you first taste it, and then as you're swallowing it, it kind of reaches a crescendo. The bitterness and the richness and the aromas of fruit and hops kind of reach a maximum, and then it falls off very quickly. And brewers would call that clipped. Mm-hmm. Like you want a beer that has a clipped bitterness. You want the beer to be very bitter because that's makes you thirsty, but you don't want it to linger. And that lingering bitterness will make your mouth kind of uncomfortable, like this fat in your mouth. It's a similar type of thing, but it's about the bitterness. And the bitterness can be from hops, it can be from the barley husk, or it could be from the yeast, it could be from the water. So there's a lot of things that will cause beer to not have a nice mouthfeel. And without that good mouthfeel, I think the experience is greatly diminished.
Yeah, and it's funny, I keep going back to like food, but like when you're eating a good chicken wing, right, and you're just like really into it, and you're like, yeah, these are really, the sauce is on point, everything, yeah. This is a great, chef did nothing wrong with these wings, but by the nature of wings and how you eat them, like every once in a while you can just crunch into some cartilage or like a little piece of bone, and
yeah,
how that can just flip the whole experience on its head.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, they are married. They sort of go hand in hand.
Yeah, well, Deb and I were talking about that last night, that she had made a lentil soup for us for dinner, and it had bacon in it, and it was the juxtaposition, the savoriness of the smoky bacon and the slight crunch of the lentils, that is that's pleasing to the human palate to have that juxtaposition. Most people like that. It's pleasurable to have both a soft and a more crisp, harder taste in so I'm not saying that you want to have gristle, because yeah, certainly you don't, but I think the sweet and sour, hot and spicy, all of these differences that come together, juxtapositions, are what make things enjoyable. So in the case of beer, the sweetness of the malt and the bitterness of the hops and the aroma of the fermentation, when they're marriaged, it's a delightful thing, like good music.
Yeah. And you know, as you start thinking of off flavors, things like that in beer, words start coming up that, you know, get in very sciencey very quick, right? Like mm-hmm. diacetyl. Yeah. And what are some of the other ones? I know there's like two or three that are like sort of crop up when you have an off flavor in a beer.
Yeah, well, there's certainly dozens, if not hundreds, but yeah, probably the top types of off flavor, you know, diacetyl or a buttered popcorn type of a character, or DMS, also called dimethyl sulfide, is like a sweet corn or tomato flavor. A beer that's contaminated with other microorganisms might have a taste of like a medicine cabinet called phenol, mm-hmm. or it could just be sour. It could be lactic, or it could be acetic, like vinegar. And acetaldehyde, which is like grape skin or apple skin, is another immature flavor. Other sulfur compounds like sulfur dioxide, that has a burnt match flavor, or hydrogen sulfide, that has a taste of rotten eggs.
Yeah.
So, there's many, 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 many more. Most beers, of course, don't exhibit that type. Those are like gross off flavors. Those are like something really bad happened.
Yeah.
You don't really find those in beer. So really in a modern brewing business, what you're looking at is this difference, subtle differences in drinkability, so that Some beers are just more harmonious than others. And the best way to judge that is when you finish a glass of beer, are you done, or do you feel like, well, that was really good, I could have another one?
Gotcha. And
that's an intangible, difficult concept that can't really be quantified with numbers. Some beers are just harmonious and soft. Other beers are hard, and angular, and not so pleasant to drink.
So it'd be very rare if you're just out in the wild to crack a beer and say, why does this taste like cardboard or Band-Aids or butter popcorn?
It certainly happens. The one that you just mentioned, the cardboard flavor,
yeah,
that is about staling. Beer is a sister product to bread. They're very similar. They're made with yeast and grain. And like bread, beer is best, most beers, not all beers, most beers are best when they're fresh. Just like a bread out of the oven. You know, if you go to the bakery in the morning, you're going to get the best bread. If you get 2-day old bread, it's going to be somewhat staled. It's the same with beer. Most beer is better when it's fresh. When it gets old, it can start to exhibit stale flavors. And in some, particularly light American lagers, the taste of cardboard is common. Or in the case of all malt craft beers that are fuller in flavor, you can get sherry-like flavors, mm-hmm, or potato-like flavors. And the bitterness is diminished and muted. So oxidized beer, the types of words we would use would be like, muted or suppressed, meaning that it's lost its crisp brightness. A fresh beer has a snap to it, has a brightness of youth. But when it gets old and slow, it gets dull, muted, and suppressed. And the bitterness impression goes down over time. The hoppy aroma changes, mm-hmm, becomes, again, suppressed, less, and less like fresh hops.
Do you guys have to like train your palate to these flavors? Like, I guess what I'm asking is like, do you have to intentionally expose yourself to a bad beer just to know what it tastes like?
Yeah. So there are most brewmasters that have gone to brewing school have gone through what's called sensory training. Mm-hmm. So as part of school, you taste beers with various off flavors in them. Schools that I went to was the Siebel Institute in Chicago, and I went to their brewmaster program. And we did sensory training. Deb actually took a freestanding course on sensory training. And in that, you would take a very light American-style lager beer, very easy-drinking, simple beer, and then they're doctored with these various off flavors above threshold level. And so, mm-hmm, then you taste them, and the instructor will tell you what that compound is. Now, everybody tastes differently. So diacetyl, for example, is considered to be, it's the taste of buttered popcorn. But to me, it tastes like the smell of dirty socks.
Oh.
Also to me, when I was in college, I had a job milking cows, and it smells like the spray of warm water on a concrete floor after you're done milking. When it steams. And yeah. So that when I taste this, that's what it's reminiscent of. So now I know that is what is diacetyl. So going forward, we all have a similar, when everybody at the table says that beer smells like diacetyl, we all know what we're talking about. So that I know people often get, they get annoyed with how when people taste wine and they pontificate, and it's, you know, always the joke, hell, I don't taste that, I just taste wine.
Yeah.
It's not a matter of pontificating. It's a matter of being able to smell something and know in your category, in your mind, of that's what I know, that I've been trained on that aroma or that taste, and it's called this, so that when I speak to somebody else, we have a common language. And if you are somebody who's interested in doing that at home, you can go on the web and find taste standards. You can buy little pills, little tablets that you would say you could buy, you know, an American style light lager and put this in the beer if you wanted to train yourself and H2S or SO2 or acetaldehyde or phenol, all of these things you can buy and train yourself so that you know what these off flavors are.
That's great. That's actually kind of great. I can imagine if you dabble in home brewing and stuff like that, it'd be a great thing to put yourself through. And then also test like how accommodating your friend circle is. Like, hey, I brewed this beer. I'm really proud of it.
That's not a nice thing to do.
And see if they're like, this is, you know what? You did a good job. This is
well, great. The other thing is that if you do this, that, you know, there's a company called Flavor Active that you can go online. They're an English company, and they'll send you these little tablets that you add to the beer. Every taster is blind to at least some flavor. So it's important that you have a group of people to taste. And so if you're really interested in it and you do this tasting, you might say, huh, I really, dimethyl sulfide, I don't get that at all. Mm-hmm. Or I don't get diacetyl. That's a good thing to know if you're serious about tasting. But it's not about trying to be, we don't like to conjure as brewers off flavors in the beer, but to understand what they are and more importantly, where they came from, that's extremely important. The other thing is often off flavors don't, when you do these little tablets and you taste these specific isolated off flavors, oftentimes when beer has a problem, there's more than one going on. And it takes a lot of years of experience to understand that when you have two or three of these together, it means this, not that. So it can be a lifetime's journey. And tasting beer is a lot like being an athlete. You have to have the natural ability. Some people are better tasters than other people, but you have to practice. So the best tasters are people that are what are called super tasters. And mostly there are not that many. There's some people are super tasters, and a lot of them are women. Mm-hmm. It seems that women have, just in general, seem to have a better palate than men. But so it's all about your genetics and how much you practice. So we taste beer every day in Taste Panel. People walk by because we have self-guided tours. They come by and they say things like, oh, I want that job. And it's not particularly like we're standing around just socializing and drinking beer. It's serious work to say, let's taste today's brew. Because we taste every single batch of beer that goes out of the brewery is tasted twice and by two different taste panels. And then we taste it again at 1 month, and then again at 3 months to assess how the beer is developing. It's serious business because you're trying to make a food and put it out into the world for people's enjoyment. And so we're concentrating and saying, does this beer taste the way that it's supposed to taste? Because we have what's called a brand profile, that Spotted Cow should taste this way, Two Women should taste this way. That's what the absolute best version is, and does it deviate from that? How far does it deviate? Is it acceptable or unacceptable? So tasting is a very, very important aspect. And in fact, being a brewmaster, certainly one needs to be educated in the mathematics and engineering of brewing, which is extremely important. But as I said before, a lot of times some great brewers have come out of being chefs.
Yeah.
Because the ability to understand flavor, which is extremely difficult. I mean, it's relatively easy to punch out values on a calculator and predicts what's going to happen when you mix hot water and malt or whatever. But to really understand and appreciate flavor is is definitely an art.
Well, yeah, and to be able to naturally do it, right? And,
oh, yeah.
And just have the, I taste this and I like it or I don't like it. And I can either, I can tell you why and I can tell you what to add and subtract, but I can't tell you the math of it, but I can tell you why I don't like this. It's probably hugely valuable.
Well, I met some head brewers at breweries that are really not trained as brewers, and maybe they're not very good with a calculator or they're not very good engineers, but their breweries may be somewhat of a drama as far as efficiencies or cleanliness, but their beers are absolutely spectacular simply because they are very, very good chefs.
Well, and as you're explaining off flavors and the perception of flavor, it just sort of illustrates to me how difficult your guys' job really is because, you know, as you said, a diacetyl can be buttered popcorn, it could be dirty socks, it could be, you know, whatever, depending on how you perceive it. So you guys are trying to basically brew to a standard palate where one person says the sky is blue, another person says the sky is blue, but they're both looking at it and one is seeing blue and one is seeing red. And you have to figure out how to split that difference.
Yeah, exactly. And sometimes people don't really know how to articulate what they think about a beer. They don't have the words. And because I think the wine, flowery words in the wine business have made people afraid to describe what they're tasting. And I always try to encourage people that there is no right or wrong answer. What you taste is what you taste. I mean, that's your reality. And since you're the customer, I want to know what your reality is. But it's hard for people to articulate. You know, we humans are very good with our eyes and very good with our ears, but we're not so good with the tactile experience of tasting. We don't really think about it. It's not something we see in the media, obviously, and it's not something that our parents, will teach us. And that's why, you know, when Teddy, your 4-year-old son, is over at our house, I'll try to prod him to say, "What do you think this tastes like when we eat something? Do you like it, but what does it taste like to you?" And that's, I think, an important aspect of the joy of life.
Yeah, I think so too. And as you were saying that, it strikes me as like, you know, creator intent is what it is. You can put out what you want and pour all the intent you want into it, but at the end of the day, you know, the consumer is getting what they get out of it, regardless of what you meant.
Definitely. and then you have to add on to that the label, because the perception, study after study have shown that people drink with their eyes. They drink the label. And if you change the label, even if you keep the beer the same, but you change the label, people's perceptions change.
So let's talk about what unfiltered beer is and what, you know, sort of that means for the product. And I know you get questions on this. Is there a term for the stuff that's left in a beer? I know it's yeast that is settled, right? But is there a term for that? Is it just sediment? What defines it, and what is its purpose, and how does that work in beers like Spotted Cow will have that, or beers like I know on one picking up some of your vintage over the years, it's on the description says you can lay it down, sort of roll it to free that stuff and have it go in the glass, or leave it up and have it not. So can we define its purpose and what it is and how that all works out?
Well, of course, beer is a malted extract of malted barley and hops, acted upon by yeast. So all of these materials will have a haze, and that haze is made up of protein from the barley malt, protein from the yeast, polyphenolic material from the hops and the malt. These materials have a tendency to bind in the beer and make a haze. That haze could be large flocks, or it could be a very fine flock. And also, yeast settles out of the beer or rises to the top, but there's always some yeast left in the beer. So most beer is filtered to become clear, treated either through a centrifuge. We run our beer through a centrifuge. Some brewers will run their beer through a filter to mm-hmm. make their beer clear. Some beers, then yeast is added back to the beer to cause a fermentation in the package. So that's what you would find in all of our wheat beers. Dancing Man, for example, Moon Man, Fat Squirrel, these are all fermented in the bottle. They're carbonated naturally by the yeast in the bottle. So on the bottom of the bottle, you will find a skiff of yeast.
Okay.
And Spotted Cow, same thing. You will find yeast. Spotted Cow is, it has a haze to it. And over time, gravity being gravity, we all are experienced with gravity, it pulls this stuff out of solution. So over time, it will settle into the bottom. At first, it stays in suspension, so you have this kind of veiled haze. But over time, it settles to the bottom. Or if the bottle is stored on its side, it will be along the neck. Mm-hmm. Along the belly of the bottle. And so sometimes people are unaware of that. They don't understand that. And so they may see a bottle of Spotted Cow that they've had in their refrigerator for, say, 2 or 3 weeks. And this sediment of yeast is settles to the bottom. And they don't understand what it is. And it maybe scares them. But it's brewer's yeast. And brewer's yeast, if, you know, not so much anymore, but in the old days, people used to mix brewer's yeast in water and take it as a vitamin B supplement. So, yeah, it's full of minerals and vitamins, full of zinc and iron and vitamins, vitamin Bs. And so if that happens in Spotted Cow or Moon Man, you know, don't stress about it. You can leave the yeast settled at the bottom and rack the clear beer off. But I wouldn't do that because the yeast is somewhat important. Spotted mm-hmm. Cow yeast has part of the fruity flavor. So what I would do is gently roll the bottle to resuspend the yeast or gently maybe turn the bottle, tumble the bottle gently a few times to get the yeast back in suspension.
And I'm guessing the same goes for like the Guzas and stuff like that. There's a benefit to having the yeast in suspension and sort of the spontaneously fermented wild sour ales.
In that case, our vintage beers are sour beers mm-hmm. From the Wild Fruit Cave are anywhere from 6 months to 5 years old when we put it into a bottle.
And, gotcha.
excuse me. And it's a blend of those beers. So it's mostly dropped clear by then. I mentioned that after some months, all of these things, this protein, polyphenols, and yeast settle to the bottom. Mm-hmm. Well, when you hold a beer in a tank for 6 months or 3 years, it's going to settle to the bottom of the tank.
Gotcha.
And so you're going to have a relatively clear beer to rack off. So the reason why our R&D beers, our vintage beers, have a slight haze. Some of them are relatively brilliantly clear, but there's no centrifugation. There's no filtration. It's just right out of the wooden tank. And sometimes, depending on the beer that we're making, we could mix young beer and old beer together so that there's live yeast in it and to initiate a second fermentation in the bottle, like we do with our Dancing Man or Moon Man, Stone Soup, etc., all of those beers that are bottle fermented. If our beer is bottle fermented, mostly, or Fat Squirrel, we put it on the label.
Gotcha.
Or you can, in some cases, when we're making a R&D beer, maybe we'll add fresh yeast and initiate a second fermentation in the bottle. So that's why you would have sediment in the bottoms of those bottles. And then the bottles are held. We might hold the bottles before we release it. We might hold the bottle for over a year. So, you know, the process of making those beers is there's the brewing of the beer. Then there's the fermentation. You know, the brewing takes a day. The fermentation might take, you know, 3 weeks. The aging in the tank might take 6 months or, as I said, 5 years. And then the aging in the bottle might be anywhere from 3 months to a year and a half.
Gotcha.
It's a wild card.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And, you know, we're talking about the, you know, so the consumer side of the brewing process, which it seems weird because the brewing process is done at this point, but it's not done in terms of things that can affect your beer, right?
Oh, yeah.
So when I'm thinking about draft lines, right, it's a very mm-hmm. simple concept in my head. Mm-hmm. There's a guy, you know, he's got a beard, or a lady, and she's got a nice, you know, she's got a nice glasses or whatever on, and they pull a handle, beer comes out, and they put it in my glass and they give it to me. And in my mind, that beer is coming to me in a way that is, that's exactly how that beer is supposed to taste. But we all know what a draft line is, but I don't think people fully understand how a draft line works. I know I don't fully understand how a draft line works and how things can affect flavor of beer after that. Can you tell me a little, can you spend a little time defining, first of all, what a draft line is, sort of mechanically, how it does what it does, and how its maintenance can sort of affect what I am drinking?
First of all, I can start out by saying that that in a place like Czech Republic, where it's a number one per capita consumer of beer, beer is very much a daily part of people's lives. The serving of beer, how the beer is tapped mm-hmm. is an art, and it is said that it is a more important art than the actual brewing of the beer. So serving of beer is more important, and mm-hmm. I agree 100% with that. And in fact, when someone is really good at that, a tapster, a bartender, and they move to a different bar, often the customers will follow him or her.
Wow.
Because the reason I tell this story is because how the beer is served is hugely important, profoundly important. And when you go to a restaurant or a tavern and you have a particularly nice glass of beer, meaning that it's at the proper temperature, it has two fingers of foam on it, it's fully carbonated in a clean glass, and it's at the proper temperature, you're going to drink two or three of them.
Yeah.
And you're probably going to go back to that tavern. So there are many, many taverns that have figured it out, and they understand that they need to serve beer in a proper way. So we put beer in half barrels or quarter barrels, so 15 and a half gallons or 7 3/4 gallons. And we send those beers to our wholesalers, and then our wholesalers do the hard work of taking it out to the bars. So they go into, say, the basement or a back room somewhere that's handy where the beer can be stored, and it should be kept at more or less, say, 38 degrees Fahrenheit. A CO2 counter pressure is put on the keg, and the beer is pushed through a hose to the tapper where the beer is served from. And there are many places along that journey that can have detrimental effect on the beer. So when the beer arrives in the keg, it's more or less as good as it's going to get.
Yeah.
So when the keg is hooked up to the draft system, if there is any mold or dirt in the line, it will go into the keg, and the keg will start to spoil. Mm-hmm. It will start to develop all of those off flavors that we mentioned. It didn't have it when it left the brewery, but yeah. The microorganisms that are growing in the line are going to be pushed into the keg, and it starts its downfall. Then you have to consider the amount of gas that you have on the head pressure. If you have too much pressure, the beer is going to come out foamy. If you have not enough pressure, the beer is going to come out tasting flat. If you are using nitrogen, a lot of times, particularly years ago, instead of CO2, taverns would use nitrogen because it meant that the beer would pour easier. So, but the beer would go flat. And I can always tell a beer that's got too much nitrogen, because when they pour it, there's no sparkle, there's no bubbles, and the foam has a creamy appearance.
Yeah.
And like, it's this is being pushed by nitrogen. And then the mouthfeel is ruined. The mm-hmm. beer has no mouthfeel. Then if the draft line is dirty, the line that goes from the keg to the bar, bacteria and mold grow in it. I mean, sometimes when a line is not properly cleaned, it's just disgusting with stuff that's growing in the line. And particularly that first glass of beer that comes out of that line in the early evening, if you're unlucky to get that first beer that comes out, it's going to be awful. And a lot of times bar owners don't really understand this. They don't understand they're losing money because the beer is, it's contaminated mm-hmm. because their draft lines aren't cleaned. So in the case of, you know, I've seen in Europe where every night they'll bust down their draft line and push it out with water, so that it stays dry and clean, and the beer is always meticulously wonderful. In the United States, the rule is that, not the rule, but the suggestion is the draft line should be cleaned every 2 weeks.
Oh, wow.
And if it's done properly, because sometimes draft line cleaners don't do a good job. The problem is the draft line cleaning is done by contractors. And if the bar owner's trying to skimp and save, they'll get the lowest bidder to come and do the work, and then you get what you pay for.
Yeah.
The draft line, they say it's clean and with air quotes, but it's not really clean. Or if the cold box is, maybe it's not working very well and the beer is warmed up. So you can have flat beer from too much nitrogen or a wrong balance of pressure. You can have dirty draft lines, which make the beer taste musty, moldy, diacetyl, sour, acetic, all of these off flavors. And then when the beer is poured, if it comes out too foamy, then the beer is going to be go flat, and mm-hmm. and the bar owner is going to waste a lot of beer to try to. You've probably seen people pouring beer and the foam is just pouring out a waterfall. That shouldn't happen. And then the last thing is beer clean glasses. The glasses need to be cleaned with detergents that are made for beer. So you can't wash them in a dishwasher with greasy food. Mm-hmm. If you've seen beer glasses that have the bubbles stick to the side of the glass and then there's no foam, it's because there's grease in there.
Gotcha.
So the serving of beer on draft is fraught with possibilities. And so we have Ben Geisthardt is our expert on draft lines, and his full job is to go around the state helping people, training draft line cleaners, explaining to bar owners if they spend the extra time and money to properly clean their lines and maintain their cold boxes and properly clean their glasses, don't wash them with food dishes, et cetera, you're going to have a pleasant experience. You know, in a restaurant, the chef is right there. So the chef makes sure anybody that's working in a restaurant knows that when the food comes out and the chef says, you know, order up, you damn well better take it now.
Yes.
Because if the food gets cold, people complain. Well, I'm envious of the chef because they know the plate is clean. They know the knives and forks are clean, and they know the food is going out the way that they want it to go out. But if the restaurateur is not doing the same thing with the beer, it's as if you're taking this beautiful steak, putting it on a dirty plate, letting it cool down to room temperature, and then taking it out to the customer. That would never happen it shouldn't happen in a restaurant. It's the same should be for the quality of beer. So as a brewer, who's somebody who's poured their heart and soul and life literally into brewing a beer and then going out to a tavern and ordering one of your beers and it comes out flat or sour or musty, or in a dirty glass, filled to the brim with no foam, like apple cider. It's just a frustrating as hell.
Oh, I bet. As you were saying that, I was like, and you're doing in the sort of the chef analogy, it would then be like, and then if the customer said, what's wrong with this? What's wrong with this plate? What are you guys doing here? And they go, I don't know. You got to call the butcher.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's exactly right. I mean, it's sort of like if a person, you know, they in the morning, they put on their nicest clothes and, you know, they do their hair and they put on their makeup and they spend, you know, a lot of time and they just put a lot of effort into making their appearance look good. And they have put on really nice shoes and they go outside and somebody drives by and splashes muddy snow all over them. Mm-hmm. That's exactly how I feel when I go into a tavern and have this experience. And it's, you know, the bar owners are leaving money on the table.
Well, yeah.
But the reciprocal of that is when you go into a tavern and you have somebody who gets it and you drink the beer that's in a properly served glass, proper temperature, proper carbonation, two fingers of foam. It's just like I usually will go to the manager and tell him, you know, you guys really did great. This is really a pleasure. And that's mostly, we put a lot of effort into it. Our company has really led a charge in the state of Wisconsin to improve draft beer quality. And I hate to say this, but I blame the large brewers because when I was growing up, when I was in college, it was the days of 25-cent draft beer.
Yeah.
And they used to take piggyback kegs, like 10 kegs on top of each other and just pour whatever. You know, it was just like feeding pigs. And the large brewers spent all their damn time advertising Swedish bikini teams and dogs and frogs and all kinds of other stuff and not dealing with cleaning the draft line. So when you when you go into a tavern and you see the old timers, they're usually drinking those beers out of the can because mm-hmm. they were taught years ago not to drink draft beer. And when craft brewing started, draft beer was more or less 6% of the business because nobody paid attention to it.
Yeah, it was okay, you're in the Wingstop now, you just need a beer, and there's the one they have on draft.
Yeah, exactly. Whereas the craft, you know, our pre-COVID, our draft beer was, you know, over 40% of our business. So it's an important part.
Oh, yeah.
And craft brewing industry has gone a long way to try to fight this this deterioration.
Well, it's a good fight to have too, because beer on draft is a wonderful thing.
Oh God.
It can be an absolutely transcendently wonderful experience to have a great beer on draft served probably in the right atmosphere. You got the food, you got family, friends.
If it's done right, it's fresh. I mean, it's more ecological because you have a keg that, I mean, we have kegs that we've had since we opened the brewery we bought them secondhand.
Yes. Yeah, reusable stuff almost up and down the line.
So there's no cardboard, there's no crowns, there's no glass, there's no labels, no cans. It's a ecologically responsible way to drink beer.
Well, and it sort of points out something that I just think there is no unskilled labor, right? There just isn't. There's just varying degrees of how seriously people take different jobs in different cultures, right? Yeah. There just are. And when you look at, when you look at Europe and how their culture evolved with food service, beverage service, how it became, it's not like, oh, that's just something you do for 2 years while you're in college. I serve beer and this is what I do.
Well, you know, it's a chicken and egg type thing. I hear business owners say, young people don't want to work. And well, you know, you got to treat them well you got to treat them well and pay them well and train them. And they'll do fine.
Yeah. Well, that's why I had a conversation with Jen from the gift shop. And you know, I told her, I said, she was sort of breaking down the starting wage for serving beer at Nuclearis and working in the gift shop. And I think I said at one point, like, well, gee, if I had that deal when I was a cook, I'd probably be behind a line right now.
Yeah.
My knees would probably be hurting a lot more than they are, but that I'd probably still be behind a line today if, you know, my starting wage and benefits and everything matched what they do here for people serving beer and treating it as an actual profession, you know?
Well, you know, and if you do a good job, if you serve your food well, you cook your food well, use proper ingredients, good ingredients, and you serve, you take care of your draft lines, you take care of your draft beer, people are going to beat a path to your door. You don't need to advertise. You don't need, you know, you don't need a clever advertising. You just have a good product, and word of mouth will, I've seen it time and time again that, and that's how you make money, not by, well, we're not doing well, so we're going to cut costs. We're going to cut wages. We're going to lay people off. We're going to buy cheaper material. That's just going to take you the wrong way. And then you wonder, people scratch their head and wonder why they're getting worse and worse and worse.
Where did everyone go?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Well, you know, we'll finish out here with a couple of things that are more on the consumer side as well, as we're hitting sort of our 45-minute mark. One of the ones, and we had a little conversation about some of these words, and you're basically, well, these are not my area of expertise. This is not something I get into, but around beer culture, they become sort of these markers that people use. One of them is whale and white whale. Are you familiar with these?
Vaguely. It's not, I'm not a big social media guy. You know, as a brewer, I try to avoid, the critiques that you see on I'm not I'm pre social media, so you're gonna have to take the lead on these two.
Well, yeah, I think you just got rid of the flip phone.
Like, yes, I did.
Yeah, like what, 4 months ago.
I would never have gotten rid of my flip phone, except that U.S. Cellular told me that it was going to be obsolete and they are no longer going to service it. So now I'm carrying around this boat anchor of a Apple phone that's. Where the hell do you put them? You can't carry them in your pocket because they're giving off all this damn radiation. I don't know what the hell these things are, but yes, you're right.
You just got rid of the flip phone. So it's good practice not to read the comments. It just is.
Yeah,
it's very good practice.
Yeah.
But from what I'm to understand, a whale is a beer that's, while rare, you have sort of an outside chance of finding it in the wild somewhere.
Okay,
like if a bottle share or, you know, maybe comes out every few years, very limited quality very limited quantity. A white whale then is like, yeah, this was like a one-off and maybe they'll do it again. But, you know, the reputation precedes it. And if you find it, someone will give you their first.
Like our very sour blackberry.
The very sour blackberry definitely fits that description. So with that definition in mind, you know, were there beers for you personally where it was like, if I could just get to this beer and try it, I think I would be happy for this moment? Or have you experienced this sort of thing of like, okay, I really want to try this beer. Where the hell am I going to get it?
Okay. Yeah. So, I've said many times, I'm a big fan of the beers of Russian River Brewing, but I'm good friends with Vinny and Natalie Clarusso. So they send us beers all the time. They send us beer at Christmas. So I have a out on that one. Then of course, for a long time, West Vlaanderen 12 from Belgium was considered the best beer in the world. And there was quite a buzz around.
Did you ever have to use the phone
to order?
To call?
Actually, what I did was I went to the brewery and stood in line was able to buy a case there.
Gotcha.
So you had to go to the Monks to get the beer. Of course, there's lots of wonderful, you know, from time to time you see the beers of the Schoenraum Brewery, Eric Toft. From near in Germany, north of Salzburg. Sometimes his beer shows up in the United States, but often you pretty much need to go to the Alps to get it. And that's a great beer. Or having Augustin or Edelstuff on draft in Munich. I mean, you can buy it in bottles here, but it's not really the same as drinking it fresh on draft. Drinking Schlenkela, which is a brewery in Bamberg. They make a rauk beer, a smoked beer. And that's, again, a kind of beer that you really need to be in the tavern to drink. It's not something I think you want to drink at home. It's a very unique beer. So those are probably the ones that I really I look forward to. Probably the beers of Treehouse. I don't think I've ever had beers from Treehouse.
Yeah, I don't think I have either.
And I'd like to taste some that I've never had it. Also the beers of the Alchemy, Heady Topper. Of course, when I'd come visit you and Katie out in Vermont, we could have that beer on draft, which is Good stuff.
That is good stuff. Like, yeah, for me, and I'm trying to think, like, you know, what would, and because, you know, you've been, you know, so generous, with the beer people send to you.
Yeah.
And also, you know, a little bit finds its way to me. I've been able to drink you know, stuff from Russian River and stuff from all over the world and country. I don't think I'd ever be able to. But yeah, I don't think I've had anything from Treehouse. But for me it was I really wanted to try Heady Topper and Focal Banger, and I got to try both of those. And the first time the first time I ever had Pliny the Elder was with you and Vinny, which I think is probably like on a top 10 beer experience kind of deal for most people in the world. Yeah. So yeah, that was my white whale experience.
You went and you got a bunch of like caps and t-shirts and stuff out of their gift shop. And so yeah. We're like, you know, we went to pay for it and Vinny said, no, you can have it. It's like, oh my God, Vinny, he got a, you know,
I was trying to tell the poor guy at the register, I'm like, no, this literally none of this is, you know, this is, I'm nobody. You need to charge me for this hat.
Yep. He said, nope. Vinny said it's on the house.
So. Would not hear of it. They are genuinely great people.
Oh yeah, they definitely are.
Well, Dan, I think we've covered some really, you know, interesting territory on concepts of how beer is served, definitions of what can happen to beer, what makes it go off, what makes it great, and all the vast, complicated things that can go into how you get from, you know, your basic ingredients in the brew kettle all the way to how your draft line can affect ultimately what you're going to be tasting. Is there any ground you think we didn't cover that you were looking forward to defining for folks?
No, I think we covered it really well, and I'll get off my soapbox about draft beer, but it's a good soapbox to be on though,
you know. I think at the end of the day, everyone wants their beer to taste good.
Yeah, that's right.
And I think for most tavern
owners, given the option, we'd prefer to have a good tasting beer.
Given the option, I think most tavern owners would prefer repeat customers, most customers would prefer good tasting beer. Right. So
it's a win-win situation for sure.
You know, and in an ever complicated world, I say pick the fights that you want, the easy fights you want to have.
Yeah,
and this seems like a fight you want to have.
Yeah, definitely.
Have a good one, Dan.
All right, thank you.